Class hosted by the Portland Underground Grad School, starting April 4th at 6:30 p.m. at Hatch, 2420 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Information on how to register for the class and more can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 10:59 a.m. coming up at 11. Pacific Underground addresses topics of solidarity and exclusion. Talking with folks experiencing exoticization around biracial identity and the identities imposed as well as claimed. That's what you get with Community Radio, produced by, for, and about your friends and neighbors on KBOO Portland, your community radio.
This is Pacific Underground, the radio show where Asian and Pacific Islanders take the mic into our own hands. I'm Jenna Yokoyama.
And I'm Tabitha Teo.
This month, we're bringing you stories of solidarity and exclusion. We'll talk about our shared civil rights history with African Americans and how that plays out today. We'll also discuss the internment of Japanese Americans and the heroes here in Oregon who fought against it.
But first, we're bringing you the next installment of Your English is So Good. It's our ongoing series about all the creative ways Asians are told that they're weird, unique, or exotic.
This month, I interviewed Kanan Schlesinger. He's a KBOO newsroom volunteer. He's originally from San Diego and half Jewish and half Japanese. We didn't initially think of him as someone for this segment, but I realized that Hapas, or half Asians, really get their own special version of Your English is So Good.
So my full name is Kanan Kenji Nakatomi Schlesinger. And I'm still like, I don't get it. Like my first name is like not particularly Anglo, so that is also kind of a weird thing. Because my name's Kanan, I have to explain that, and then people, I think, expect for that to do some sort of like explaining of my appearance, and it doesn't, and I think that just kind of like this, things just fall a little bit flat after that, and I don't really take the initiative on like being like, oh, my appearance and my identity is explained by my name in this way. It just, you know, like, you're going to have to do the work to get to know me if you want to figure that one out.
Has anyone ever actually said your English is so good to you?
No, and I don't think that is an experience that I will ever have, because I have this privilege of looking, like, I can blend. I can tell people that I'm from any part of the world and mm-hmm. they'll believe me, I guess. Like when I was in college, I wanted to kind of experiment with what I could get away with. And so I'd tell people that I was from Morocco and they believe me. So very easily believable. And I always like ask people like, what do you think I am? I kind of like playing that guessing game. And I get some really interesting reactions. Like for a long time, I would get like, oh yeah, you look like you probably are part Mexican, or you're part Latin American, or like, you know, just like people I think are scared to like make specific guesses. They're like, some part of like South America or Latin America. Just from my dad's side, I got a lot of the physical traits, and I think that's what makes for such a confusing initial interaction when people are like trying to figure out my ethnicity.
Do you feel exoticized ever?
If I can articulate some sort of microaggression that I've experienced, it is probably like being exoticized, because it is sort of like exotic, and like it's hard to escape that when you're talking about it in our cultural atmosphere. And I encourage it implicitly when I play the guess my race game, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, guess what I am, and it is kind of a messed up thing to do to myself, and like for the conversation, and for like a genuine earnest arrival at an understanding, you know, it's problematic that I do that. And I was feeling that as I was like retelling it to you, but it is interesting to see those attitudes when I do reveal what my heritage is, and they're like, oh, that's so interesting, cool. And the conversation that follows is like a lot of I don't even know how to change that into a noun, exoticization. I feel exoticized, I guess.
Like, what kind of examples of, like, what people say?
I think people, like, ask about, like, how that plays out in my house, how that like, influenced my upbringing. There's this term that was thrown around when I was growing up, and it's Buju, like Buddhist Jew. And that never felt good, and I never objected to it. So it was just kind of allowed to continue happening. And my dad would even say it sometimes. And I never heard my mom say it because I don't think she felt super comfortable with it, too. It was kind of something that just, like, it was able to, like, roll downhill easily from, like, the white point of view, and, like, it passed. It just sounds pejorative. It sounds bad. But, like, that to me felt like I was being exoticized as, like, this, like, unique combination born out of an unlikely pairing between, you know, Buddhist roots and Jewish ones. So, yeah, things like that, like, at the time felt innocuous enough, but, like, over time, as I become more conscious of, like, all of these issues and of my family's past, it is kind of a problematic term to just throw around without, like, explanation, as just, like, a label, I think.
Once you, like, reveal your great exoticism to everyone that you're actually a half Asian guy, do you find that people treat you any differently as a result?
That is a good question, and it's a tough one to answer. My inclination is to say no, but I don't often have the opportunity to, like, have a relationship with someone and have the awareness of, like, oh, they don't know who I am. They don't know my heritage. And then for that information to be revealed and then to see the change. I don't think I bring that awareness to meeting people and having those discussions. But it's a super interesting thing to think about. And I do think about it sometimes. I haven't, like, really explored it. And my sense is that it doesn't change too much because my appearance, again, isn't, like, overtly Japanese. It's, like, ambiguous. And even after I say that I'm half Japanese, I think there's, like, a, is he sure about that?
Did you ever get stuff about half Asians being the most beautiful people?
I've heard that a lot from white people. I don't get it directly, but I think I deflect compliments. I'm, like, pretty pro at that. So I don't. But I think that's an interesting thing. And I think there is a lot of racism in there, in that comment, you know, especially apparent when it comes from white folks, because it's like, when you're mixed with us, it's like the perfect combination. Like, and that's not what they're intending to say. But, like, that message, I think, is wrapped up in there. Yeah. It's like, in order to, like, you know, gain passage to, like, cultural ascendancy and be, like, like the most beautiful specimen you can, you know, mate with a white person, and, like, your offspring is going to be beautiful, and look at all these beautiful people, look at all these beautiful specimens we have of, like, assimilees. I get creeped out by that. Like, I am genuinely, like, put off, creeped out, and offended by when people say that with a certain tone. I think a lot of, like, my own identity as Hapa was informed by how I saw a lot of my full-blooded second generation or first generation Asian American peers treated, like, early on in elementary school, even though I didn't have, like, the rational tools to make sense of it. I can think of these two girls in particular that were in my class in, like, first grade, Alice and Elise, and they're both Chinese American, and they were both, like, brilliant and both, like, really kind and really meek, and everyone expected them to be that way. I would continue to see Alice's and Elise's, like, as I went through school and as I, like, you know, passed through all different sorts of social situations. And I think that was a very distinct treatment and a very distinct existence from my own. It's definitely a privilege because I am kind of like an ethnic chameleon. Like, I rarely feel like I'm just, like, standing out. And I think I've sought to blend in because it's just comfortable. There is, like, a fear in, like, being identified as an other, as someone who is, like, non-white, because I grew up in a context in Southern California where there happened to not be very many Asian Americans. And so the ones that were around were tokenized in a way, not in a very, like, aggressive, overt way, but they were nonetheless. They were looked to as the Asians in the class, and treated in that way, even though maybe it didn't cause them excessive amounts of grief at the time. So it's like a privilege in that way, because I didn't feel myself viewed in that sort of light, where a lot of this like self other stuff comes to play is like elementary school, specifically at lunchtime for me, because my mom would pack me at lunch. And I was actually kind of like, as I was revisiting this, I was like kind of like gaining this like newfound appreciation, like rear view mirror, like, oh, my mom loved me so much. She packed me like these rice balls, like onigiri, and all these different things that were like weird, like, right? And like I felt weird, I felt ashamed. And I think a lot of that shame like led me to like kind of like want to bury all of this stuff and like kind of like hide my lunch and like eat by myself because I didn't have a sandwich, because I didn't have like a pack of Cheez-Its like everyone else. And I think I sought to achieve that and achieve white lunchness, you know? Like I wanted to like arrive at that moment where I could like open up my lunch and eat like a normal white person. And I think that was like an oddly powerful setting where all of these things were starting to form. And luckily for me, I didn't get shamed. I didn't really have much reinforcement for these feelings of shame. It was almost the opposite. People were like, oh, like there would be this initial reaction of like, oh, dude, what the hell is that? Mm. And you'd be like, is that just like rice in a ball? Why would you like that's
why
not,
would you eat that?
Why would you eat that? And I didn't have the know-how and ability to like explain what was going on then. So I was just like, dog, it's my lunch. Like I'm just trying to eat my lunch. Like my mom made it for me. And then I'll get like ashamed and like mad at my mom for making me a Japanese lunch, which is a real shame. Like that's a shame to look back on and like remember those feelings of like, just like,
Have you ever heard people saying something like to your mom since she's Japanese? Like,
I'm really glad that I was just thinking about a story that occurred to me this morning. I was traveling with someone that it was not really by choice, and they were the ones kind of like allowing me to travel. And it was on a boat. And we were on this like extended trip. At one point, like they, out of curiosity, they were inquiring about my heritage, and they're like, oh, Kanan, I understand that your mom's side of the family is Oriental. And they used the word Oriental, and it took like maybe like a good like 5 seconds of like stumbling over like making noises, like guttural noises like that, because I was like buying myself time and like also trying to like talk myself down real quick because of how like weird of a like I'd never encountered that. And I think that like in California West Coast culture, it's like understood that you don't throw that term around because it is very antiquated and colonial. And then it like occurred to me, like this person happened to be like upper middle class person, affluent enough to like own a boat, and was from the Midwest. And it dawned on me in that moment before I opened my mouth that this might have been the way that it was acceptable to talk about these issues. In response to the comment, is your mom Oriental? Or I understand that your mother is Oriental. There wasn't a ton that I could say because I was trying to meet this person where he was at. I couldn't like really come down on him out of the gates, just like swinging and being like, well, first of all, let's get something straight. You're not to use that term. It's very offensive, and I resent that you just opened your mouth with that term, and it's souring the moment. Like I didn't want to shame him for using that term, so I just kind of like gently corrected him, and it seemed to work. I said, "Oh yeah, my mom is Japanese, and I am half Japanese," and he was like, "Oh okay," and the conversation didn't really go much further than that, and I don't think they had an interest in bringing it any further than that. They were just more like curious and like, oh, that person is other and I'm white. I wonder what they are, just to like satisfy my very surface level curiosity in that. And I happen to be spending like months at a time in close proximity to this person, so I might as well know what they are, you know? But then it like, as I reflect on that, it's so clear to me how important it is to meet people where they are when they say things like that. Especially if they're not being antagonistic. Like, it would be one thing if he was like, your mom is Oriental and that's a shame or something, you know? there was no hate in what he was saying, I guess. And so to respond to it with aggression would be to escalate the situation and discourage that person from ever bringing up someone's Asian roots again, or any ethnic roots if they were not white. So I guess like my takeaway was meet people where they're at and encourage their curiosity and discourage ignorance and senseless use of outdated language that's offensive. I think he would have benefited from hearing me say that term is offensive, and I don't think I did. And that's my regret of that interaction, not equipping that person with the understanding that hasn't been an acceptable term to use in decades and decades, and it probably never should have been used. I think microaggressions are probably like the best picture of like where we are with race in America, because it's not permissible to be overtly aggressive against minorities. So like what is left and what shines through is these subtle moments. Someone feels more comfortable sitting next to like their white friend than their Asian friend or their black friend or their Latino friend. But with people like in our everyday lives who want to be allies and want like justice in so many different ways, I don't think there's as much awareness around like the walk that people are walking. And to call people out on the walk that they're walking, or maybe call them in, be more inclusive and friendly about like how what they're doing is visible and does create a microaggression ripple effect, and like kind of like fills in the backdrop of like this very much not post-racial world that we live in, this very fearful world that we like currently exist in and trying to like do our best and make a more tolerable place.
That was Kanan Schlesinger being interviewed by Jenna Yokoyama. For those of you who are just joining us, this is Pacific Underground on KBOO Community Radio.
We've talked a lot about how Asians and Pacific Islanders experience racism in America, but it's impossible to really explore this topic without exploring how minority groups relate to each other. In February, NYPD officer Peter Leong was convicted of manslaughter after fatally shooting Akai Gurley, an unarmed black man. This sparked protests by Asian Americans in New York City and in other cities around the country. And during the Oscars, Chris Rock was roundly criticized after bringing three Asian kids on stage and referring to them as accountants from PricewaterhouseCoopers. He then said, "If anybody's upset about that joke, just tweet about it on your phone that was also made by these kids."
So on this next segment, producer Alan Montecilio dives deeper into the connection between anti-Asian racism and anti-black racism.
On November 20th, 2014, Akai Gurley and his girlfriend walked into a seventh-floor stairwell inside of the Brooklyn housing project in which they lived. NYPD officer Peter Leong was conducting a routine patrol with his partner. After hearing Gurley enter the pitch-dark stairwell, Leong was startled and discharged his weapon. The bullet ricocheted off the wall and hit Gurley in the chest. Gurley died minutes later. And in February, Officer Leong was found guilty of manslaughter and official misconduct. Now, there's a lot to unpack here that we simply don't have time to get into. For instance, the fact that Leong had only been an officer for 18 months, or the exact NYPD rules regarding when and when not to put your finger on the trigger of your gun, or the role of cops patrolling housing projects in New York in the first place. What I want to focus on instead is the aftermath and response. Peter Leong was born in China and immigrated to Brooklyn as a child. And for some Asian Americans, it's hard not to look at the many other shootings of black men by white cops that have gone unaddressed. It can be hard not to ask, why only Peter Leong? Why is he the only one facing justice?
We are angry because we are also hurt by the systemic injustices and the structural oppression and the racism that continues to pervade this country. I think as Asian
Americans...
This is
Jess Fong in an interview with the website Fusion. She's a recent college grad in New York City who opposes Leong's conviction. And this video went semi-viral, or at least it got a lot more attention than Asian Americans are used to getting. I also talked to Doug Lee, a grassroots organizer in New York. He says that Leong's trial coincided with a wave of anti-police sentiment in America, and that's why he was convicted.
I believe that there are multiple political factors are in play, and overzealous prosecution also comes into play. the incident happened at the height of anti-police sentiment. It was immediately after the Mike Brown riots and immediately after the Eric Garner riots. So there is anti-police sentiment, and they were out, I should say. There's almost a atmosphere of a witch hunt. Unfortunately, this incident occurred at the wrong moment.
But there's a lot more going on here. Asian Americans aren't talked about very much, and all of a sudden we see these protests going on without understanding the larger picture. So I spoke with Scott Nakagawa. He's the senior partner at Change Lab, a grassroots political organization focusing on demographic change in America. He described the show of support for Peter Liang as, well, awkward.
So, you know, I think it's a bit awkward to rally around that situation. When there is no real clear indication of any racism having affected the outcome in that trial. So the situation, I think, is one in which people are grasping for opportunities to make their voices heard, and for good reason. You know, Asian Americans have long been persecuted in the United States, and that fear of persecution persists in many communities, particularly in the communities where it has been the most acute, here inside of our borders.
Scott pointed out to me that the discussion around this trial is not just awkward in the sense that it's kind of tricky or difficult or bothersome. The very framing of these events doesn't quite sit with him, because they represent a tiny sliver of a giant and diverse population. He told me that the way the media has described these protests is a little misleading.
I think that there's a polarizing way in which people have framed this as Asians versus Blacks, right? When in fact, what we're talking about here is a tiny minority of a large and diverse community of Asian Americans that has chosen to protest against Peter Liang's conviction. So it's not really representative of a broad opinion in the Asian American community. And the way that some African American activists have responded by basically, attempting to vilify certain Asian activists is also not representative of, you know, the broad community of people who are concerned about racial justice issues in the African-American community.
So just to recap, an unarmed Black man was shot by a Chinese-American police officer who was then convicted of manslaughter. All of this during a time when police shootings of Black men are becoming more and more well-known, but with very few, if any, actual consequences for those officers. Meanwhile, a vocal, sizable, but small minority of Asian Americans say they shouldn't be taking the fall for an unjust criminal system. But even then, the very group that these protesters are trying to rally in support of this Chinese American officer is itself so dizzyingly large and diverse. I mean, I myself, a Filipino, was interviewing Japanese American Scott Nakagawa about the conviction of Chinese American Peter Liang. And the only reason this is now my issue too is because Asians have been defined as one exotic and foreign group from the beginning. All of this was starting to make my head spin. For Scott, despite all the racism that Asian Americans face, he couldn't overlook the fact that Akai Gurley was Black, unarmed, and killed by a police officer.
People are saying that the Peter Liang conviction is an indication of a kind of racism that's victimizing someone in the Chinese American community. But in fact, what we have here is a situation in which a police officer shot an unarmed person and did not respond to it appropriately. It is a situation in which, at last, someone has been held accountable, according to the rules, for an act of recklessness that ended the life of someone who was innocent and unarmed.
He also reminded me of how racism against Asians fits into the larger goals of racism in general.
We need to dirty up that narrative and make it clear that what's happening here is a process of racial formation, that a very diverse group of people that includes, you know, East Asian business investors and high-tech workers and war refugees from places like Cambodia are being lumped together, given a meaning and identity that then is used as a lever in American politics. So when we talk about Asian Americans, for example, many, many people immediately think of the model minority. The model minority is an entirely synthetic thing, completely made up. It does not actually have any kind of basis in any sort of real evidence that there's a cultural or racial meaning to the relative success of the Asian American aggregate, right? I remind you again of the immigration system being a kind of labor sorting system, right? People are selected who will likely be more successful as they come into this country. And most of us were not born in this country. So most of us have gone through some kind of sorting system of that sort. But then once here, we're cast as a smokescreen for the failure of American meritocracy and basically a way of condemning those who have not had that kind of success. For example, African Americans, because it suggests that the way you get out of poverty is just by working hard. You know, we need to understand that race is a classification system. Race is not, you know, it's not either race or class, right? Race is class. The effect of race, like the effect of economic class, may be financial. But the reality is that what we do in the United States is we classify people in this manner in order to basically organize power. So, you know, in many of our communities, those are the kinds of beliefs that reinforce notions that are being moved around us that are anti-Black. And so our job should be to challenge them and to talk about the reality of the situation, because those are the things that are holding racist beliefs in place. We have to prove that they're just myths, that they're not real, just as race is not a real thing. There is no biological or cultural basis for race. Race is a political construct.
In the New York Times, the writer J. Caspian Kong wrote, "No amount of nuance or qualification or appeal to Martin Luther King will change the fact that the first massive nationwide Asian American protest in years was held in defense of a police officer who shot and killed an innocent Black man. It is my belief that Asian Americans have to form their own way of talking about race, privilege, and justice, one that acknowledges both our relative privilege and the costs of our invisibility. But that language takes time to build, and at the next political action, the message will certainly still be clumsy and riddled with contradiction. I only hope it serves a more just cause than the freedom of Peter Liang." Just this Wednesday, Peter Liang tearfully apologized to Akai Gurley's girlfriend. At the same time, the district attorney's office announced that they would not be seeking prison time. Something tells me we'll be talking about this for a long, long time.
You're listening to Pacific Underground. Here are some events that are coming up over the course of the next month. Late March and early April are full of opportunities to see some great API artists coming through the Portland area. On March 25th, today, Tao and the Get Down Stay Down will be playing at the Wonder Ballroom at 9 in an all-ages show. Then tomorrow at 8 p.m. at Turn 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 on Northeast Killingsworth, Katie Lau's recording project, Painted Zeros, will be playing a show. On Wednesday, April 5th, at the Alberta Rose Theater, an event called Soul Slack Hawaii will feature two great solo artists. Makana and Paula Fuga will feature in a double bill show. Smith Western's frontman Cullen Omori will be in town on April 3rd at the Doug Fir. The show's doors open at 8 p.m. and it's $12 to get in. Then on the 10th of April, Jackie Green, a folk singer and songwriter, will tour through town, stopping at Mississippi Studios to play an acoustic show. Then lastly, Alima Considine of the Sexbots will be celebrating her fifth full-length album's release with a show at Dante's on April 24th at 8 p.m. On April 10th, you're invited to join the Vietnamese Student Association at Oregon State University for an evening of singing, dancing, Vietnamese cuisine, and more. The student organization is putting on their annual cultural show they've entitled 100 Years of Happiness. The event will be in the Memorial Union Ballroom in Corvallis and will begin at 6 p.m. Chinese-American activist, author, and feminist Grace Lee Boggs passed away last fall at the age of 100. Join Oregon Humanities for a free public screening of American Revolutionary, The Evolution of Grace Lee Boggs, on April 3rd at the Hollywood Theater. The event goes from 2 to 4:30 p.m. and will be followed by a panel discussion. Dr. Erica Lee, an immigration history professor at the University of Minnesota, will be in town to speak about her book, The Making of Asian America, on Thursday, April 14th, at the Oregon Historical Society. On April 1st, as part of the Oregon Stories Project, Linda Tumura will tell the story of George Akiyama, a Japanese-American man who triumphed over racial discrimination to achieve inspiring, notable successes. The Oregon Stories Project will take place at the Columbia Center for the Arts in Hood River on April 1st at 7:30 p.m. You could find links to all of these events and more on our Facebook page. If you'd like to share any events with us, please do so by finding us on Facebook or Twitter at Pacific Underground.
If you're just tuning in, this is Pacific Underground on KBOO, the show where Asians and Pacific Islanders take the mic into our own hands.
During this presidential campaign, Republican frontrunner Donald Trump called for a complete ban on Muslims entering the United States. But for Japanese Americans, this culture of fear sounds eerily familiar.
Jenna Yokoyama explores how the U.S. forcibly moved thousands of Japanese Americans from their homes, all in the name of keeping our country safe.
Back in December 2015, I was asked about a recent interview of Donald Trump's. When questioned as to whether or not he would have supported Japanese-American internment during World War II, he gave an inconclusive answer. Adding to this was the hate speech he made the day before.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country...
With all the incendiary speech coming from some of the candidates and their supporters, Japanese-American internment is a topic that's been on the forefront of my mind. While growing up in the 1980s, I had a hard time wrapping my mind around the idea that a culture of fear is what allowed my family to be incarcerated in internment camps. When I would ask my grandparents about life in America pre-World War II, they would usually say something about how it was different back then. In the environment we're living in these days, I can see that times may have been different, but that doesn't mean that times have changed completely. As our modern culture of fear allows the Trumps of the world to rise, I can't help but wonder if America will repeat its mistakes from the past. Looking back on my own family's history, I find myself concerned when I remember that it doesn't take a dictator to take away your rights. Take the case of Japanese Americans. The president at that time was not some oppressive dictator. No, it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a man often lauded as one of our greatest presidents. So, how did America come to incarcerate tens of thousands of American citizens under the leadership of such a highly regarded man? To help me answer this question, I spoke with Professor Greg Robinson.
I am professor of history at Université du Québec à Montréal, University of Quebec at Montreal for the French Challenged.
Professor Robinson is literally the man who wrote the book on Roosevelt's decision to intern the Japanese. In his book, By Order of the President, Professor Robinson explains that during his lifetime, Roosevelt was recognized as a great president.
Which he was. And he helped save America from the Depression, and he was a great war leader in World War II, and most responsible for creating the United Nations.
But like any president, Roosevelt came with his controversies too.
His indifference toward Jews fleeing the Holocaust, his temporizing on black Americans, and his treatment of Japanese Americans.
When we talk about Japanese American internment, the story usually starts with an attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941.
1941, a date which will live in infamy. United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
You see, when Pearl Harbor was attacked, Americans were caught by surprise. Before that moment, no one could imagine an attack on U.S. soil, kind of like how the events on 9/11 rocked our modern consciousness. This moment that shook America's feeling of safety riled up societal fears that had already been in place for years before. In the 1930s, tension between the United States and Japan were building as Japan was militarily taking hold of many parts of Asia. Political leaders began to question whether or not Japanese people in the United States would remain loyal should a war break out between the two countries. At the same time, institutionalized racism against the Japanese in the U.S. was common. Targeted laws against the Japanese were passed, such as prevention of immigration, forbidding of land ownership, and blocking of citizenship eligibility. Despite these policies, the Japanese-American community thrived.
In the West Coast, Japanese Americans, and by this I mean not just the immigrants, but more particularly their children born in the United States, United States citizens, represent only about 1% of the population, but they are a visible minority. They are a successful minority, and so they are an easy minority to pick on in times of trouble.
Adding to the heated environment was the media. Even before the war, newspapers spread false rumors about Japanese spies and Japanese-American farmers poisoning crops. Regardless of the fact that none of these stories were true, they helped to fuel a culture of fear.
Scare stories created a momentum for action. After the war began, it became not just a wild fantasy, but it became almost accepted. It created a climate of opinion where people were ready to believe the worst about Japanese Americans and act on it in spite of there being absolutely no proof.
Sensationalism by the media was nothing new.
When the Justice Department instituted raids on Japanese American houses after Pearl Harbor, the media trumpeted this finding that the Japanese Americans had been arrested with all sorts of guns and ammunition. Well, it's true, because they investigated a sporting goods store, and the sporting goods store had in its stock a lot of guns and ammunition.
And although fear and suspicion of the Japanese grew, they did have a few allies.
There were black Americans who spoke publicly in favor of Japanese Americans. There were whole generations of school teachers who lauded the academic performance and the good conduct of the Japanese American children. There were liberals and religious figures who were interested in praising their Americanism. Even conservatives were interested by the campaigns of organizations like the Japanese American Citizens League to proclaim the loyalty of Nisei, that is, American-born citizens of Japanese ancestry.
As war crept closer, there were questions about what would happen to the Japanese in America. Some people called for their removal, while activists in the Japanese-American community called on the government for acknowledgement of their civil rights. Japanese-Americans were promised protections that would never come to fruition. The government's eventual decision didn't come overnight. It came in stages. First, the discussion focused solely on Japanese aliens. Then it eventually turned towards anyone with Japanese ancestry. Roosevelt was sent conflicting advice from his advisors about the best course of action to take.
The War Department, which supported the demands of the military commanders on the West Coast to institute mass removal, went up against Attorney General Francis Biddle in the Justice Department, who said that it was not necessary and it was bad for morale. They didn't say it was unconstitutional for the army to round up people, but they said that it was not needed and it would be harmful.
2 months after the attack on Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, the order that would pave the way for internment. Now, an important thing to understand in how this all worked is to realize that nowhere in the executive order did it explicitly order people to be rounded up. What it literally did?
What it literally did was simply gave the Secretary of War authority to appoint people who could designate military zones. And within those military zones, the Army had authority to remove civilians, keep civilians, prevent from going out of them, and to provide aid to civilians in either going out or staying in.
With the entire West Coast declared to be a military zone, mass removal of over 100,000 people began to take place. Many Japanese Americans protested the order by voluntarily moving out of the military zones and resettling in areas like Utah and east of the Colorado Rockies. But ultimately, the vast majority of Japanese were sent to camps, losing everything. Entire families were given just days' notice that they were to be forced from their homes for incarceration camps hundreds of miles away. The majority of them were American citizens. Many were children. While incarcerating citizens without trial may seem like something that should warrant some protest, the number of public detractors were few. Those who the Japanese needed the most to speak up remained palpably quiet.
The usual liberal and labor groups were very silent. Norman Thomas, the head of the Socialist Party, who was the only nationwide political figure to oppose Executive Order 9066, said that he had never found an issue that was as difficult to rouse the usual liberal and labor opinion on, as the case of the Japanese Americans.
The number of public voices speaking out against the action may have been small, but the number of supporters for internment were actually in the minority. However, they were a loud minority with powerful interests behind them, powerful enough to sway the public conversation. Some who supported internment did so out of fear that Japanese Americans were unloyal to the U.S. Then, there were those who stood to gain financially by exploiting the Japanese who were being forced to sell off their farmland, homes, and businesses for a fraction of the cost. And how did the president feel about all of this? It's hard to say, since he left little documentation behind.
We can't interpret to adopt what he meant, but we can be reasonably sure that he knew that there would be some protest from groups about this kind of mass action, and certainly it would be expensive to undertake. It would mean diverting resources, but, no president really cares that much about the Constitution in times of war, and Roosevelt certainly felt that he had an overriding objective to win the war. And so he just felt that, you know, the government would face whatever problems they had to deal with as they came up. The important principle was to get the people out of there.
Now, while the importance of the president signing the executive order should not be understated, for me, it's also important to remember how many different people contributed to getting that order onto Roosevelt's desk. Because events like these don't happen in a bubble. After delving into this topic with Professor Robinson a bit, it's clear that the answers are far from simple. The ever-present culture of fear played a strong role. Lies and propaganda were rampant, and those in power were good at exploiting it. For myself, I struggle to find answers that leave me hopeful that history won't repeat itself. I can't help but wonder how we're okay with having so many presidents who steer clear of protecting the rights of those who need it the most. As an everyday citizen, I ask myself, how do I help stop history from happening again? Here's some advice from the professor.
What I do, and what I hope other people will do, is indeed to talk about the example of the Japanese Americans as a perfect model of what can happen when people take on a group that's despised because they have vague fears and they're scared.
So I guess I am doing something to help speak out against history. I'll keep following Professor Robinson's advice by continuing to retell the story. Because it's up to us to fight against the culture of fear by rising up with actions of hope.
That was Pacific Underground producer Jenna Yokoyama.
For our final segment of today's show, we arrive back in present-day Oregon. You've probably heard of Japanese internment before, but you might not know about the civil rights heroes who fought against it.
Minoru Yasui was a Japanese-American lawyer from Hood River. He was the first Japanese-American to graduate from the University of Oregon's law school, and he fought these laws that targeted Japanese-Americans.
After he died in 1986, his fellow activists fought to make sure more people knew his name. In November 2015, President Barack Obama posthumously awarded him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And this year, the Oregon legislature declared that March 28th be called Minoru Yasui Day.
Atlan Montecelio learns more about Min Yasui and the fight to gain visibility for Japanese Americans.
My name is Peggy Nagai.
My name is Chisao Hata.
When we reopened his World War II case, I was his lead attorney doing that. And I co-founded the Minoru Yasui Tribute Committee with his daughter, Holly.
And I'm officially a dance specialist for Portland Public Schools, so that's my full-time, everyday job. And then I'm an artist, a performing artist, and an activist right in town.
I took the point on the nomination for the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Minoru Yasui is part of a group of people that came to Oregon very early on in the late 1800s, mid-1800s. And those Japanese that settled here settled in Hood River, Oregon. And they kind of liked Hood River because it reminded them of Japan and Mount Hood and Fujiyama, Mount Fuji. And so his family settled there, as did my family. in Hood River.
He was the first Japanese-American lawyer in the state of Oregon. And when the military curfew came down in 1942, in March of 1942, he tried to find a test case so that somebody would violate it and he would represent that person to test constitutionality. And he couldn't find a test case, so he became his own test case. He walked the streets of Portland and got himself arrested so that the courts, he could go into the court system, the federal court system, and say that a military curfew imposed upon American citizens is unconstitutional. So after he got himself arrested, he had a trial, a one-day trial, and that was in June of 1942. And after that, he was taken to Minidoka internment camp in September. And then he came back for the sentencing in November. And the judge found him guilty. The judge of Federal District Court of Oregon said that this law, this military curfew, is unconstitutional as to U.S. citizens, as imposed upon U.S. citizens. But because Yasui had worked for the Japanese consulate in Chicago, that he had abdicated his U.S. citizenship by working for the Japanese consulate, and therefore he was not a citizen, and therefore the law was valid as to him. And he then spent 9 months in solitary confinement in the Multnomah County Jail as his case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The court heard his case in 1943, and they found that he didn't abdicate his U.S. citizenship. He was still a citizen, and that the curfew was constitutional as to U.S. citizens based on military necessity.
So I had heard about Minoru Yasui through my work in redress and reparations during a period of time when we were educating ourselves, but also America, and bringing it up again that, you know, we needed to talk about the civil rights that were violated during World War II and the internment of Japanese Americans. And he, of course, was a very active spokesperson. It started out as a movement to bring the history of Japanese Americans and the internment up to the forefront. And I think it almost was a way for Sansei, or third generation, to help address the healing that needed to happen, not only for ourselves, but for our parents and our grandparents. So it didn't start out as a government thing. It mm-hmm. started out as a healing and educational movement.
So in the early 80s, there were researchers that found evidence in the National Archives that said that the Office of Naval Intelligence, the FBI, President Roosevelt sent his own person to look at the Japanese-American community on the West Coast to see if there was a problem. And the government knew that all these reports said that it's not a problem. You don't have to incarcerate them. We've been spying on their community for many years, et cetera. And there was no act of espionage or sabotage on the part of Japanese Americans.
In my case, I didn't grow up hearing about camp. In fact, it was just the opposite. My parents never spoke about it. And the only time I heard Japanese was when they were actually speaking about it, but I couldn't understand.
My parents were incarcerated, as well as all of my relatives. And my father's family had bought a farm in Boring. So they had to leave their farm. They also had to try to get it leased, because if the mortgage wasn't being paid while they were incarcerated, it would be foreclosed upon. So my father's family came back. People had stolen things from them. The land was still there, but no one would sell him insurance. There were mass meetings in Gresham High School saying, don't let the Japs come back. His neighbors rallied against him. It was hard for him, them to sell their crops to anybody. So I grew up really poor without indoor plumbing, eating government surplus food in the winter because they had to start all over again. It was a hard time for people like my father and mother who were U.S. citizens, who were born in the U.S., who had never gone outside the U.S. to be treated so harshly by their own government and then to have to come back and start all over again. My mother at the time of the war was 19. My father was 22. They weren't married yet, but they could only bring with them what they could carry.
My parents were married in camp. They weren't originally together, so they had to go through quite a bit to get in the same camp. They never talked about it, like I said. And so there was always a sense of denial of self. That's what I felt like. And I know it was not just me, but from that experience that was directly related to the World War II internment. Growing up in Des Moines, Iowa, I would not have been born there. I would have not grown up there had it not been for camp. My experience as a sansei was directly related to what happened to my parents and their internment during World War II.
You knew him and worked with him. I want to know a bit more about what he was like.
Well, he had a very strong conviction, a strong constitution, and he was the ideal client at the same time. So I was a little apprehensive because he's my father's generation, I'm his daughter's generation, and I was going to represent him. And he's a lawyer.
A lawyer representing a lawyer.
Yes, he was wonderful. He listened to everything that I said. He had his own mind, but he was very collaborative. And he said, I don't know if we're going to win, but we're going to give them hell, Peggy.
Well, I think what was inspiring about Min is he was very energetic and very clear in his thought and very articulate. So he was a spokesperson for civil rights, and he could really talk to people and help you understand what were the issues that were involved from a legal, from a social, from a political point of view. And so he really was inspiring. And I think that we really needed that voice then. We need that voice now. And we need to know that there were Japanese Americans, men and women, who were inspiring us.
I mean, think about it. He jeopardized his legal profession and his liberty to test the constitutionality. You have got to believe pretty strongly that your rights are going to be vindicated for somebody to do that. And I've asked tons of lawyers, groups of lawyers, as late as, 4 weeks ago, would you do this? Would you put your liberty and your profession on the line to test the constitutionality of a law? And one person out of 120 raised her hand, and that's been the average. So you can just imagine if lawyers aren't willing to believe the Constitution, but he did.
If I asked even teachers that I work with, who are your Japanese American heroes? Who are the Japanese Americans who have inspired you? They wouldn't have too many answers. And so that's why we want to make sure that Min Yasui, people like Minoru Yasui and Yuri Kochiyama and Grace Boggs and a lot of people who have led us. Well, Breaking the Silence itself is a wonderful play that came back. That play really inspired, I think, a lot of my involvement and deeper involvement in theater and in the arts. It was Reader's Theater. And Reader's Theater is a very interesting way to bring people together, to have them experience a piece without having the costs of a full production, and particularly when there's a historic context. it was going to Hiroshima, taking the play to Japan. And I think it really was like going back in a way to say, this is what happened to us since we left. You know, when we left Japan in the mid-1800s, late 1800s, we went to lots of places. We went to Latin America. We went to America. We went all over the globe. And here's one story. This is our American story. And for Japanese in Japan, and it was all translated, and, you know, there were many, many photos, it was, you know, they cried with us. They laughed with us. Some had not heard the story before. And it really was that sense of going home in a way and saying, you know, this is what happened and this is our story.
You know, one of the reasons I went to law school was for justice and equity. So when I read and heard about the Supreme Court cases in con law class, it just really just... made me so angry. But what could you do? The Supreme Court had ruled on these cases. Little did I realize 5 years out of law school that I would be given the opportunity to reopen, to be the lead attorney to reopen the case. But I always felt very sad that Yasui had died before we actually could get the evidentiary hearing. So when we decided to go for a Presidential Medal of Freedom, and I said that I would be the point person to get the nomination in, it helps me complete these many decades of work on his case to have him receive a Medal of Freedom and be the only Oregonian to have ever received a Presidential Medal of Freedom. It actually has helped me bring some closure to an important issue. And then, you know, recently we had a bill through the Oregon legislature, and that bill passed both the House and the Senate unanimously. So
March 28th.
Now going to have a permanent Manoah Yasui Day.
Yeah.
Well, and to me, having grown up in this state, it means a great deal to me.
I think for me, it's more than stories. It's our history. And it's the history told through stories. I mean, when we only have a paragraph in history books, when children and young people learn about the history of America, that it's more than that. And that everyone that has come to America has a story and a history. And we all gain from each other's history. But if we don't know it, like if I don't know part of the African-American history, or if I don't know the Latino history, if I don't know Native American stories and history, then I know less. It's been determined for me what I should know. And that is in the textbooks and the schools that I've gone to that are more traditionally American. And that should change. We should all, whether we're Caucasian, Asian, African American, whatever we are, whatever race we are in America, culture we're from, we should all know each other's history, because each of us had a role in building a strong America. But if we only think that there's one group that made the strong America, then it's not the whole truth.
That was producer Alan Montecelio. I'm Tabitha Teo, and you're listening to Pacific Underground on KBOO.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Pacific Underground is produced by me, Tabitha Teo, Alan Montecelio, Kanan Schlesinger, and Pamela Santos. Our show is edited by Alan Montecelio.
Special thanks to all of our guests this month, Kanan Schlesinger, Chisao Hata, Peggy Nagai, Scott Nakagawa, Greg Robinson, Doug Lee, Daniel Hong, and Wendell Britt.
Our theme music is by Chops. You can find more of their music at chopsmusic.tumblr.com.
If you like our show, get in touch with us on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/PAC Underground. Email us at pacificundergroundpdx@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks again for tuning in. I'm Jenny Okuyama.
And I'm Tabitha Tew. Tune in again next month for another episode of Pacific Underground.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Leidia Oi, produced by Imago Theater. The play runs from March 11th through the 27th at the Imago Theater in Portland. Set in a hospital in 1956, the Leidia Oi is an erotic ghost story written by Yukio Mashima based on a 15th century no play. Again, that's the Leidia Oi, March 11th through March 27th at the Imago Theater, 17 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, this is John Chuck, host of Progressive Spirit, asking the question, if there's no God, where's the hope?
The hope of life itself. If you say, well, look, if there's no God, what's left? Well, what's left is the world. What's left is everything around us.
John Caputo is the author of The Folly of God, A Theology of the Unconditional. Listen to weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/progressive spirit.
Heaven's here on earth.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Don Jacobson. I'm moving on. We'll be here in just a minute or so. But right now, I'd like to let you know that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from True West, presenting harpist, keyboardist, and vocalist Joanna Newsom, March 28th at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. Robin Pecknold opens the show, and tickets and information for Joanna Newsom on March 28th are available at portland5.com. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood River and the Gorge at 91.9 FM,